What's up, Doc? Number one, Lauren Stiles of Dysautonomia International on What's Exciting Her Right Now by Court Johnson, June 30th, 2024. Health Rising's What's Up, Doc? Zoom video series asks chronic fatigue syndrome, ME/CFS, fibromyalgia, long COVID, and related diseases experts, what's up? What's exciting you now? This first talk features Lauren Stiles, the leader of Dysautonomia International. The Zoom interview is below in the text version of the article, and below that is an overview of the interview that includes some added content. Lauren's story. We will get to the what's up part, but first, I had to ask Lauren about the illness that led her to found Dysautonomia International. A healthy, energetic 31-year-old environmental law attorney, Lauren suddenly developed postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, or POTS, following a ski accident that produced a concussion and intracranial hypertension. Bringing up thoughts of craniocervical instability and a compressed brainstem, she described a spine that had been compressed together not by lax tendons, but by an accident. In any case, the injury damaged her autonomic nervous system, which we will see then tweaked her immune system. She described a harrowing trip through the medical profession. It took her several years, but she finally self-diagnosed POTS from her hospital bed and got a neurologist, who had apparently never heard of POTS, to agree. After another convoluted journey, she ultimately came to find that Sjögren's syndrome, a disease she believes is greatly underdiagnosed, had triggered her POTS. IVIG treatment, which came with its own set of serious issues, helped greatly. At no time over the first couple of years did Lauren have an easy ride through our medical system. In 2012, Lauren, who had been engaged in nonprofit work before, founded Dysautonomia International, or DI. A nonprofit organization that quickly became the leader in the dysautonomia field. Dysautonomia International produces yearly international conferences, educates patients, provides information on doctors, and has dysautonomia, POTS, and long COVID research funds. A big family, lots of cousins. Because dysautonomia is the one factor that shows up in ME/CFS, fibromyalgia, POTS, long COVID, etc., Lauren will probably be the most centrally positioned person I will talk to. As a dysautonomia expert, Lauren has her eyes on everything from more obscure autonomic conditions like baroreflex failure and autoimmune autonomic ganglionopathy to conditions like chronic fatigue syndrome, ME/CFS, fibromyalgia, and long COVID. Noting that POTS was the most common and ME/CFS the second most common, comorbid diagnosis in a long COVID study, she called them cousins. She believes these diseases are more alike than different. Things like small fiber neuropathy, antibodies that disrupt the autonomic and sensory nerves, inflammation, and metabolic abnormalities appear to pervade all these diseases. Her assertion that if we find something in one disease, it will likely show up in the other diseases brought to mind Avindra Nath's belief that if we solve one, we will solve them all. Lauren was a case in point. Through her healthcare journey, she met the criteria for chronic fatigue syndrome, ME/CFS, fibromyalgia, POTS, and mast cell activation syndrome, before she was finally diagnosed with Sjögren's syndrome. Take fibromyalgia. Few people associate fibromyalgia with orthostatic intolerance, or POTS, yet multiple studies suggest orthostatic intolerance may be common in fibromyalgia. That makes sense, given the evidence that autonomic nervous system problems could be contributing to the pain, sleep, digestive, exercise, and standing problems. At least 8 studies suggest that orthostatic intolerance is present in fibromyalgia, yet the orthostatic intolerance issue is virtually ignored. A 2018 Health Rising poll found that 83% of fibromyalgia patients said their doctors had never recommended a tilt table test. Even if the fibromyalgia patients had taken a tilt table test, it's likely that many of them would still have been misdiagnosed, which is why I thought Dysautonomia International's decision to provide transcranial Doppler equipment to several doctors and research groups was simply brilliant. As Lauren explained, ME/CFS and POTS have near identical symptoms, but if you don't show a high heart rate on a tilt table testing, you'll likely be told everything is fine. Visser, Van Kampen, and Rowe have shown, though, that virtually everyone with ME/CFS, whether they have increased heart rates while standing or not, has reduced blood flows to the brain. That is the core problem with these diseases, not increased heart rates. With this equipment, doctors can show that everything is not fine after all. And that brought up one thing Lauren is excited about, the STAT earpiece. The exciting STAT. Lauren said she's genuinely excited about the potential of the STAT earpiece, recently rebranded to Lumina, which can measure blood flows to the brain. She's not the only one. I recently talked to ME/CFS expert Teresa Dowell, who is really excited about the device's potential to assess treatment effectiveness, pacing, etc. We thought the earpiece would be available by now, but I was told November is now the expected release date. Lumia is presenting new research at their conference showing that blood flow to the head is a better predictor of dysautonomia symptoms than heart rate in POTS. That's no surprise. Getting a device like this embedded in healthcare would be a huge win for everyone struggling to get validation for these diseases. Could any doctor dismiss data showing reduced blood flows to the brain? Sjogren syndrome, a majorly underdiagnosed illness in the ME/CFS, POTS, fibromyalgia, and long COVID sphere? Lauren suggested whatever condition we get diagnosed with first will tend to swallow up all our subsequent symptoms. With our search effectively over, we get stuck with the treatments available for that condition while possibly missing the treatments available for other conditions, which brings up Lauren's Sjogren's syndrome story. Lauren believes that, absent her Sjogren's syndrome diagnosis and the door it opened to IVIG, she could have been bedridden for life. Her POTS, mast cell problems, migraines, and post-exertional malaise all got much better on IVIG. And in the text version of the article, there are a number of links you can check out for Health Rising's IVIG series. Lauren believes that Sjogren's syndrome is widely underdiagnosed in the ME/CFS, POTS, fibromyalgia, and long COVID communities. The Sjogren's diagnostic criteria is something of a mess. For one, the diagnostic criteria used by doctors is research-based, not clinically based, i.e., it's highly restrictive, so much so that Lauren herself, because she does not have the antibodies to Sjogren's, about 40% of Sjogren's syndrome patients do not, would not meet it. Lauren pointed out a study which showed Sjogren's patients with a more neuropathic presentation, like those with ME/CFS or fibromyalgia, are more likely not to have Sjogren's syndrome antibodies. While no drugs have been FDA approved, off-label drugs are available and clinical trials are underway. As noted above, Lauren's ability to get IVIG was critical to her improvement. Note that she highly recommends getting intramuscular IVIG shots over the infusions. She recommends following the Sjogren's Advocate blog. See the link in the text version of the article. Check out Trish's ME/CFS, FM, myasthenia gravis story for another story about how a different diagnosis opened up new treatment options. Whether Lauren's spinal injury led to the development of Sjogren's syndrome is unclear, but Lauren noted that a study showed that concussions send the autonomic nervous system into a tizzy. Immediately after a concussion, both symptomatically and at the biological level, everyone after concussion looks like they have POTS. Most people, of course, recover, but a subset get diagnosed with a chronic illness. She believes that the reason that people who have experienced a concussion have a lifetime increased risk of all-cause mortality is inflammation. Tying all these strange and mostly neglected diseases, such as ME/CFS, fibromyalgia, POTS, and long COVID, together, She asserted that chronic autonomic dysfunction is going to lead to chronic immune dysfunction. That made sense, as the autonomic nervous system is a major regulator of the immune system. The tie that binds all these diseases together is some sort of autonomic impairment. Could autonomic nervous system dysregulation set the stage for triggering these and more diseases? She noted that very early in the course of their illness, people with rheumatoid arthritis and Crohn's disease already exhibit autonomic dysfunction. Lauren explained that during an infection, the autonomic nervous system explodes into action, sometimes to the point of no return, which brings us to a possible ANS tamer, vagus nerve stimulation. Vagus nerve stimulation. Dysautonomia International recognized the autonomic implications of COVID-19 very early in the COVID pandemic and attempted to get a vagus nerve stimulation study going that would crank up the parasympathetic tone and downregulate inflammation during acute COVID. Interestingly, Lauren noted that benzodiazepines such as Ativan, Xanax, Clonopin, and Valium can do the same thing. It's their ability to stabilize mast cells and tone down sympathetic nervous system activity, and not their ability to reduce anxiety, that makes them so helpful at times in these diseases. A presentation at the upcoming Dysautonomia International Conference will show that vagus nerve stimulation helped pediatric POTS patients with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, EDS. Another study found that NEMOS, NEMOS, a European vagus nerve stimulator, reduced symptom severity and functionality. In all, three different Dysautonomia International funded trials have shown efficacy in three different groups with POTS. A nice track record. If Parasym, a European vagal nerve stimulation company, gets approval for its device in the US, people in the US will have more options. Parasym will be presenting at the Dysautonomia International's conference this year, June 28th to 30th, 2024. When I suggested that wouldn't it have been great if the Recover Initiative for Long COVID had funded a vagus nerve stimulation trial, Lauren, her voice rising a bit, said Recover turned down a VNS or vagal nerve stimulation application because it hadn't done its homework. It rejected the application because the vagus nerve stimulation would not lower heart rate in POTS. Vagus nerve stimulation, however, is not used in POTS to lower the heart rate. You'd have to stimulate all day long for it to do that. Instead, it's used for a few minutes a day to lower the inflammation. That episode highlighted a big hole in the Recover program. Somehow, despite the very early evidence that POTS was a problem in long COVID, it lacked experts in POTS. Lauren believes that VNS, vagal nerve stimulation, is a benign, safe possibility for people with all these diseases. Because the field is dominated by small companies, it's taking a while for the devices to take hold. Check out some recent vagus nerve stimulation trials. Links in the text version of the article. The Recover Initiative flops again. Quote, when you give nearly $2 billion to people with no experience in post-viral syndromes, don't be surprised when what you get is something that's disconnected with what the patients actually need. Lauren Stiles. Lauren was on multiple planning committees for Recover and described a mostly out-of-touch effort. Lauren felt that, for the most part, Recover never took the patient input aspect of Recover seriously, despite Recover lauding this again and again. While some individual investigators did involve patients, she felt it was given lip service at the highest levels of the Recover leadership. Dysautonomia International's request that researchers with decades of experience studying these illnesses be included at the leadership level was ignored. She said, quote, when you give nearly $2 billion to people with no experience in post-viral syndromes, don't be surprised when what you get is something that's disconnected with what the patient actually needs. Ouch! When asked if Recover was adjusting to the many critiques and bad press it's received, the answer was, absolutely not. Double ouch. instead of acknowledging that changes need to be made, she's seen more defensiveness and an effort to close the ranks on Recover's part. In short, Recover feels they're doing just fine. Researchers from prestigious institutions like Harvard, Yale, and Stanford all urged Recover to do functional autonomic testing in a subset of its patients. Yet 3 years later, it is still not doing that. The consequences: no data on functional autonomic dysfunction associated with long COVID from the biggest long COVID effort on the planet, leaving doctors clueless. Meanwhile, research outside of Recover has shown that 70 to 80% of long COVID patients have dysautonomia. Note that Recover is doing tilt table testing in its Tier 3 patients, but isn't employing the functional autonomic nervous system tests recommended. It is also funding two autonomic nervous system clinical trials, one using IVIG and one using ivabradine. Lisa McCorkle, the founder of the Patient-Led Research Collaborative, feels much the same way about the Recover initiative. POTS gets an ICD code and interest from drug companies. Early Recover initiative studies relied on electronic health records, which, because there is no ICD code for POTS, concluded there was no POTS in long COVID. The researchers apparently missed the fact that because no code for POTS existed, it couldn't have shown up in their studies. Outside Recover, of course, studies found not only that POTS was common in long COVID, but that it was associated with significantly more disability. Getting the ICD code, G90.A, for POTS in October 2022 was a signature achievement of Dysautonomia International. Despite the fact that POTS is not a disease of the heart or an arrhythmia, it's a tachycardia, it used to land under ICD code 149.8, other specified cardiac arrhythmias. That code included numerous other medical conditions like Brugada syndrome, reentrant atrioventricular tachycardia, ectopic rhythm disorder, and other arrhythmias, none of which have anything to do with POTS. POTS is not an arrhythmia condition. Dysautonomia International presented evidence for a change to the U.S. Center for Disease Control Committee, which approved the new ICD code, which is G90.A. Instead of being shunted in under heart conditions, POTS is now found in the autonomic diseases section. ICD means International Classification of Diseases, and getting an ICD code may seem like a small thing, but it has big consequences. It makes it possible to understand how prevalent POTS is, the cost of treating it. It helps with disability, and of course, electronic health data studies will now pick it up. Interestingly, Lauren said the implementation of the ICD code has also prompted pharmaceutical companies to start digging into POTS for the first time. The goal now is to make doctors aware of the code change so that they can put it in POTS patients' medical records. Check out Dysautonomia International's letter that patients can give to doctors that helps explain what the ICD code and POTS are all about. MECFS's ICD code, by the way, is R53.82. And you can check out the links for that in the text version of the article. The insulin resistance dysautonomia connection. When asked what else excites her now, she noted that Cynthia A. Shibao at Stanford recently published a paper titled "Worsening Postural Tachycardia Syndrome is Associated with Increased Glucose-Dependent Insulinotropic Polypeptide Secretion." After Dr. Shibao noticed that many POTS patients feel worse after a high carbohydrate meal, she showed that POTS patients eating these meals release a peptide called GIP, which tells the pancreas to release insulin, potentially increasing the risk of insulin resistance, i.e. pre-diabetes. My first thought was, finally someone is exploring this very common reaction. Plus, sympathetic nervous system activation, a common finding in POTS, stimulates GIP. She noted that normal blood norepinephrine levels may not reflect high intraneural norepinephrine levels. Insulin sensitivity, in turn, can cause sensory and autonomic nerve damage. A new pathway to POTS shows up. Plus, the finding lends itself to possible treatments. The other silver lining is the huge funding that diabetes and associated conditions get, which Dr. Chabot has been able to tap into. Dr. Chabot recommends that POTS patients try a low-carb diet. An NIH Center for Post-Infectious Diseases. Lauren said she was 100% behind the effort to build a center for these diseases at the NIH, helped to draft the legislation, and explained why. She talked about a failed attempt by a well-known and well-funded researcher at a major university to get a multidisciplinary genetics immune dysautonomia-funded long COVID study at the NIH. The researcher was told by the various institutes that they couldn't fund it because other institutes were responsible for different parts of the study. The application was rejected without even being reviewed. Right now, ME/CFS researchers are not talking to or collaborating with fibromyalgia researchers. POTS researchers are not talking to ME/CFS researchers, etc. An NIH center that prioritized subjects of interest that had these diseases be studied together, that was intent on showing commonalities between them, etc., would allow all these diseases to move forward together so much more quickly. Could the ganglia have it? Take post-exertional malaise, or PEM, the signature symptom of ME/CFS. Is it found in POTS? And if so, in what percentage of people with POTS? Right now, we have no idea. After I brought up the recent Gulf War illness study showing no PEM in Gulf War illness, Lauren pointed out that a Gulf War illness study found damage to the autonomic and sensory nerves, or ganglionitis. Might autonomic and sensory nerve damage be the tie that binds all these diseases together? In an upcoming interview, fibromyalgia researcher Daniel Claw will highlight how important he believes damage to the sensory processing plays in fibromyalgia. Unfortunately, there are no tests right now for ganglionitis, but Lauren, again showing how much she is up to date on all these diseases, noted that autopsy studies have shown damage to the ganglia in ME/CFS. Ganglia problems have also shown up in post-treatment Lyme disease, and animal data indicates that COVID-19 can damage the autonomic ganglia. Dr. Martinez Lavin has proposed that the buck may stop at the dorsal root ganglia in fibromyalgia. Plus, the fibromyalgia study that transferred serum from fibromyalgia patients to mice found that the mice suffered from damage to the autonomic ganglia. A POTS serum study is underway. Small fiber neuropathy testing can pick up damage to the sensory nerves, but most labs do not assess the autonomic nerves that are just under them. Note that many things, ischemia, metabolic problems, insulin resistance, and infection, can cause damage to these nerves, and small fiber neuropathy can be found in many diseases. The good news is that these small nerve fibers can grow back. Lauren lost 85% of small nerve fibers. After IVIG, her small nerves weren't completely back to par, but they all grew back. Thanks to Dysautonomia International's input, Recover's autopsy study is going to assess the autonomic ganglia in long COVID. One wonders what role damaged autonomic and sensory nerves will, in the end, play in these diseases. They could explain a lot. Lauren ended the interview by emphasizing the need to explore the overlaps between all these different yet similar fields. Creating an office at the NIH would be a major step forward. Check out Dysautonomia International's conference that is underway right now. DI makes it very easy to get a recording of the conference, just $25. Better treatments coming. Lauren is much better now, but after being bedridden for years, She knows how tough this illness can be and how hard it can be to keep going. She said, though, that so much research is going on that she felt strongly confident we will see better treatments soon. Health Rising's Quickie donation drive blasts off. Thanks to the over 100 people who have contributed over $5,500 to Health Rising's Quickie summer fundraising drive. Access is important, and as this blog shows, and as other blogs in the What's Up Doc series will show, Health Rising has access to the top experts in the ME/CFS, FM, and long COVID fields, and we are talking to them. If that's the kind of communication you want to see, please support us. Give a one-time donation. You can donate at the link in the text version of the article.